This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Peace Talks, a novel of the Dresden Files by Jim Butcher. Read for you by James Marsters. For Frostbite Doom Reaver McBain Butcher. I miss you, little buddy. Chapter 1. My brother ruined a perfectly good run by saying, "Justine is pregnant." That kicked me completely out of my mental zone, and suddenly I became aware of the burning in my legs, my heavy breathing. I dropped out of gear and gradually slowed down until I was walking. In the blue light of July pre-dawn, Montrose Beach was deserted. It wasn't hot yet. That's why I was up at, oh God, 30. Thomas slowed down, too, until we were walking side by side. His dark hair was pulled back into a ponytail. Like me, he wore an old t-shirt, sweatpants, and sneakers. He was one of those men who were so good-looking that it made people check around to see if they were being pranked. He was also a vampire. "Let me get this right. You picked me up this morning," I said. "We came all the way down here. We did 6 miles in the sand, and neither of us said a word. The whole city is still and quiet. We've barely seen a moving car."
"Yeah?"
Thomas asked. I scowled. "So why'd you have to go and ruin it?" His mouth twitched at the corner. "Sorry to spoil your man time there, Hemingway." "Tch," I said. We had reached the end of our last lap and were almost back to the cars anyway. I stopped and turned toward the lake and breathed. The weighted vest I was wearing pinched at something on my shoulder, restricting its movement, and I rolled it irritably. Far out over the lake, the blue had begun to lighten. Sunrise would be soon.
"You sure?"
I asked.
"Very," he said.
I glanced aside at him. The ideal symmetry of his face was stretched tight with tension. His eyes, which were sometimes blue, usually gray, were tinting toward reflective silver. I knew the look. He was hungry. "How did that happen?" I asked him. He looked aside at me without turning his head and lifted his eyebrows.
"Did no one ever have this talk with you?"
I scowled. "I mean, weren't you careful?"
"Yes," Thomas said. "And my kind are all but infertile to boot. Happened anyway."
"What happens now?"
"The usual, mostly. Except that the baby's hunger will draw life energy from Justine. She's going to be fed upon continuously for the next 7.5 months.
I studied him.
"Is that dangerous?" He swallowed.
"According to the family records, just over 50% either don't survive the delivery or die shortly after."
"Hell's bells," I said.
I kept staring out at the water. Blue had given way to lighter blue and then to the first wash of gold. Chicago was starting to wake up around us. The burble of noise from the freeways had begun to escalate by slow degrees. Birds in the sanctuary at the end of the beach were beginning to sing.
"I don't know what to do," Thomas said. "If I lose her..."
He didn't continue. He didn't have to. There was a universe of pain residing in that ellipsis.
"You'll be fine," I said. "I'll help."
"You?"
Thomas asked. A faint smile lightened his profile for a second.
"I'll have you know I've been a full-time dad for well over a month, and Maggie isn't dead yet. I clearly have mad parenting skills."
The smile faded. "Right, but, Harry," I put my hand on his shoulder.
"Don't borrow trouble," I said. "There's plenty of that going around without looking for more of it. She needs taken care of, so whatever needs to happen, we'll do it."
He stared at me for a silent moment and nodded once.
"Meanwhile," I said, "you should probably focus on taking care of yourself so you can be there for her."
"I'm fine," he said, waving one hand. "You don't look fine."
That made him jerk his head toward me and glare. The expression changed him. Suddenly, he looked less like a human being and more like something carved from marble. Angry, angry marble. I felt my shoulders tense up in the presence of a creature I knew was genuinely dangerous. He glared at me, but he had to look up to do it. My older brother is right around 6 feet tall, but I'm 6'9". Usually I have a commanding advantage when looking down at him. Today I had less than usual since I was standing in a depression in the sand. His voice was cool. "Leave it, Harry." "If I don't," I asked, "are you going to punch me?" He scowled at me. "Because you know I'm all Captain Winter now. Might not go the way you assume it would." He sneered. "Please, I'd hogtie you with your entrails." I squinted at him. Then I spoke carefully and slowly. "If you don't take care of yourself and act like a sane person," I said, "maybe we'll find out." He scowled and started to speak, his expression darkening. "No," I said simply. "No, you don't get to do that. You don't get to go into an emo vampire angst spiral over this. Because that's selfish, and you can't afford to think that way. Not anymore." He stared at me for a while, his expression furious, then thoughtful, then disturbed. Waves rolled in on the beach. "I have to think of them," he said. "Good man would," I said. His gray eyes stared out at the lake. "Everything is going to change," he said. "Yeah. I'm scared," he said. "Yeah." Something in his body language relaxed, and suddenly he was just my brother again. "I'm sorry," he said, "that I got edgy. I don't like to talk vampire stuff with you."
"You'd rather pretend we were just normal brothers with normal problems," I said.
"Wouldn't you?" he asked.
I squinted down at my feet for a while. "Maybe. But you can't ignore things that are real just because they're uncomfortable."
"I'll sit on you and make you take care of yourself if I have to. But it's probably better for them if you do it."
He nodded.
"Probably. I have a solution in mind," he said. "I'll work on it."
"Good enough." I raised both of my hands, palms out. "I'm not your dad," I said. Then it was my turn to frown. "Your dad's side of the family is going to be an issue?"
"When aren't they an issue?" I said. Silence stretched. Over the lake, the sky began to swell with the first faint band of deep orange. It had already gotten to the skyscrapers behind us. The light moved steadily down the building sides. "Sometimes," Thomas said, "I hate what I am. I hate being me."
"Maybe it's time to work on that," I said to him. "Isn't really the kind of thing you want to teach to a little kid." He glowered at me, then he said, "When the hell did you get deep?"
"Through experience, wisdom I have earned," I said in Yoda's voice. But it tickled my throat weirdly and made me start coughing.
I dealt with that for longer than I should have needed to and was straightening up again when Thomas said, his tone suddenly tighter,
"Harry."
I looked up to see a young man approaching us. Carlos Ramirez was of average height, maybe of a little more than average muscle. He was filling out, getting that solid adult look to him, though for some reason I still expected to see a gangly kid in his early 20s whenever I saw him. He'd grown his dark hair out longer. His skin was bronzed from inclination and the sun. He walked with difficulty, limping and leaning on a thick cane carved with symbols, his wizard's staff. He wore jeans and a tank top and a light jacket. Ramirez was solid, a proven fighter, a good man to have at your back, and was one of a very few people on the White Council of Wizardry whom I considered a friend.
"Harry," he said. He nodded warily at Thomas.
"Wraith." My brother nodded back.
Been a while.
Since the deeps, Ramirez agreed. Carlos, I said, how's your back? I know when it's going to rain now, he said, flashing me a quick grin. Won't be dancing much for a while, but I won't miss that damn chair.
He held up a hand. I bumped fists with him.
What brings you out from the coast?
Council business, he said. Thomas nodded and said, I'll go.
No need, Ramirez said. This is going public this morning. McCoy thought it would be good for someone you knew to tell you, Harry.
I grunted and unfastened the damn weighted vest. White council business typically gave me a headache.
What is it this time?
Peace talks, Ramirez said. I arched an eyebrow.
What, seriously? With the Fomor?
The supernatural world had been kind of topsy-turvy lately. Some lunatic had managed to wipe out the Red Court of Vampires completely, and the resulting vacuum had destabilized balances of power that were centuries old. The biggest result of the chaos was that the Fomor, an undersea power hardly anyone had spoken about during my lifetime, had risen up with a vengeance, taking territory from various powers and wreaking havoc on ordinary humans, mostly the poor, migrants, people without many champions to stand for them.
A convocation of the Unseelie Accord signatories, Ramirez confirmed. Every major power is coming to the meeting. Apparently the Fomor requested it. They want to resolve our differences, everyone's sending representatives.
I whistled. That would be something. A gathering of influential members of the greatest powers in the supernatural world, in a time where tensions were high and tempers hot. I pitied the poor town where that little dinner party was going to take place. In fact, I felt my mouth open.
Wait. They're doing it here? Here? In Chicago?
Ramirez shrugged.
Yeah, that's why McCoy sent me to tell you.
Whose stupid idea was that? I asked.
That's the other reason McCoy sent me, Ramirez said, grinning. A local baron offered his hospitality.
Marcone? I demanded. Gentleman Johnny Marcone, former robber baron of Chicago's outfit, was now Baron Marcone, the only vanilla human being to sign the Unseelie Accords. He'd managed that a few years ago, and he'd been building his power base ever since.
That stunt he pulled with Mab this spring, I said, scowling.
Ramirez shrugged and spread his hands. Marcone maneuvered Nicodemus Arcleone into a corner and took everything he had, without breaking a single one of the bylaws of the Accords. Say what you will about the man, but he's competent. And impressed a lot of people.
Yeah, I said darkly. That was all him.
Tell me that the council doesn't want me to be our emissary.
Ramirez blinked.
Wait, what?
Oh, God, no, Harry. I mean, no. Just no.
My brother covered up his mouth with one hand and coughed. I chose to ignore the wrinkles at the corners of his eyes.
Ramirez cleared his throat before continuing.
But they will expect you to be the council's liaison with Winter, if needed, and to provide security for the senior council members in attendance. Everyone will be conducting themselves under guest right, but they'll all bring their own muscle, too.
Trust but verify, I said.
I took off the weighted vest with disgust and tossed it onto the beach. It made an extremely weighty thump when it hit.
Ramirez arched an eyebrow.
Christ, Harry, how much does that thing weigh?
220, I replied.
He shook his head. His expression for a moment was probing and pensive. I'd learned to recognize the look, that I wonder if Harry Dresden is still Harry Dresden, or if the Queen of Air and Darkness has turned him into her personal monster look. I get that one a lot these days, sometimes in the mirror. I looked down at my feet again and studied the ground. I could see it better as the sun drew nearer the horizon.
You sure the senior council wants me to be on the security team? I asked.
Ramirez nodded firmly. I'm heading it up. They told me I could pick my own team. I'm picking you. I want you there.
Where you can more easily keep an eye on him, Thomas murmured.
Ramirez grinned and inclined his head. Maybe. Or maybe I just want to see some more buildings burn down. He nodded to me and said, Harry, I'll be in touch.
I nodded back. Good to see you, Los.
Wraith, Ramirez said.
Warden Ramirez, my brother answered.
Ramirez shambled off, leaning on his cane, moving without much grace, but with considerable energy.
Well, Thomas said.
He watched Ramirez depart, and his eyes narrowed in thought.
It looks like I'd better get moving. Things are going to get complicated.
You don't know that, I said. Maybe it'll be a nice dinner, and everyone will sing Kumbaya together.
He eyed me.
I looked down at my feet again and said,
Yeah, maybe not.
He snorted, clapped my arm, and started walking back to the car without saying anything further. I knew he'd wait for me. Once he was gone, I stepped out of the depression in the sand and picked up my weighted vest. Then I turned and studied it as the sun began to come up in earnest and I could finally see clearly. I'd been standing in a humanoid footprint. It was well over 3 feet long. Once I looked, I saw that there was a line of them, with several yards stretching between each one and the next. The line led toward the water. The rising lakeshore breeze was already beginning to blur the footprints' outlines. Maybe their appearance was a complete coincidence.
Yeah, maybe not.
I slung the weighted vest over my shoulder and started trudging back to the car. I had that sinking feeling that things were about to get hectic again.
Chapter 2 Thomas came with me back to my place for a post-exercise breakfast. Well, technically it was Molly's place, but she wasn't around much and I was living there. The Svarthof Embassy in Chicago was a neat little building in the business district, with a lawn that was an absolute gaping expanse when you consider the cost of real estate in town. It looked like the kind of building that should be full of people in severely sober business attire, doing things with money and numbers that were too complicated, fussy, and god-awful boring to be widely understood. As it happened, that was pretty close to the truth. There was a little guardhouse on the drive-in, a fairly recent feature, and a bland-looking man in a bland and expensive fitted suit and dark sunglasses looked up from his book. We stopped at the window, and I said, The purple Mustang flies tonight. The guard stared at me. Hang on, I said and racked my brain. Sad Tuesdays present no problem to the local authorities. He kept staring at me. State your names, please. Oh, come on, Austrey, I said. Do we have to do this dance every single morning? You know who I am. Hell, we watched the kids play together for an hour last night.
I wasn't on duty then, Austrey said, his tone entirely neutral, his eyes flat. State your names, please.
Once, I said, just once, would it kill you to let security protocol slide?
He gave me more of that blank stare, a slow blink, and said, Potentially, which is why we have security protocols. I gave him my most wizardly glower, to no avail. Then I grumbled under my breath, making mostly Yosemite Sam noises, and started fumbling around in my gym bag. My name is Harry Dresden, Winter Knight, vassal to Molly Carpenter, Lady Winter of the She Court, and under the protection of her guest right. This is Thomas Wraith, also her guest, friend to Lady Ivana.
He is one of Ivana's lovers, Austrey corrected me meticulously. He nodded at Thomas.
Sup, Austrey, my brother said.
Duty.
Austrey said seriously and opened a folder, flipping through a number of profile pages with photographs in the top corner. He stopped on my page, carefully compared the image to me, and then another to Thomas, and nodded. Passphrase, please. Yeah, one second. I finally found the folded-up piece of paper with the weekly passphrases on it in the depths of the gym bag. I unfolded it, shook sand off it, consulted it, and read. All of my base are belong to me. What does that even mean? Austrey stared at me in frustration for a moment and sighed. Then he looked at Thomas. And yours? The itsy-bitsy spider went up the waterspout, Thomas said promptly, without referencing a cheat card, because he has nothing better to do with his time than memorize random passphrases. Austrey nodded approvingly, flipped the folder closed, and put it away. Please wait, he said. He hit a button and muttered a nearly silent word, which I knew would disarm about 2,000 lethal magical wards between me and the front door. Then he nodded at me and said, You may enter. Thank you, I said. He leaned back in his chair a bit, relaxing, and the illusion of unremarkable humanity that covered the Svarthalf went liquid and translucent. Austrey had gray skin with a gymnast's muscles beneath. A head a little too big for the rest of him, and absolutely enormous black eyes, like that alien in the autopsy video. Beneath the surface illusion, his expression was relaxed and pleasant. My Ingrid would like another playdate with Maggie and Sir Mouse. Maggie would enjoy that as well. I'll contact Mrs. Austrey. He nodded. That is her designated area of responsibility. Cards again tonight. I'd like to, but I can't commit to it, I said. He frowned slightly. I prefer being able to plan my evening activities. Duty, I explained. His frown vanished, and he picked up his book again. That is different, of course. Please let me know when your duties permit you to spare the time. I gave him a nod and went forward. Austrey was the Svarthalves in a nutshell. Anal retentive, a ferocious stickler, inhumanly disciplined, inflexibly dedicated to his concepts of honor and duty. But good people once you got to know him. It takes all kinds, you know. We passed through two more security checkpoints, one in the building's lobby and another at the elevator that led down to the embassy's large subterranean complex. One of the other Svarthalves peered at my driver's license, then at me, and insisted on measuring my height and taking my fingerprints to further verify that it was actually me and not an imposter wearing a hairy suit. I guess I shouldn't have minded it so much. Adding more checks did mean more security, even if it was occasionally applied somewhat maliciously by guys like Gedwig here. Still, the Svarthalves' particular blend of paranoia and punctiliousness meant that my daughter would be that much safer under their roof. But some days it chafed, and this was one of them. We slipped into the apartment and found it still dim and dark and cool. I stopped for a moment to marvel at the miracle of air conditioning in the summer. Magic and technology don't get along, and the aura of energy around a wizard like me plays merry hell with pretty much anything developed after the Second World War. I never lived in a place whose AC survived more than a few days, but the Svarthalves had constructed this apartment especially for Molly. It had lights that worked, and a radio that worked, and hot water that worked, and an AC that worked. And I had no idea how the clever folk had managed that. The Svarthalves were famous craftsmen. Word was, if you wanted something made, they could make it. Maybe I should get Molly to ask for a TV, or an internet thing, device, one of those internet thingies. I figure everyone is so insane about the internet, there must be something cool there. Anyway, when we finally came all the way into the living room, Mister, my big gray tomcat, appeared as he always did and flung himself at my shins in a welcome home shoulder block. I leaned down to rub the base of his ears the way he liked, which he received with great magnanimity, before dismissing me to continue my day. He walked by Thomas, rubbing his cheek against my brother's leg once, and once only, to mark him as Mister's property, then he walked off in regal disinterest. Mister wasn't as young as he used to be, but he still knew who ruled the apartment. My daughter was still sleeping on the couch, covered by a heavy blanket. Next to her lay a shaggy gray behemoth about the size of a Budweiser horse, my temple dog, Mouse. He didn't even lift his head or open his eyes when we came in. He just yawned and wriggled into a slightly more comfortable position before huffing out a breath and going back to sleep. Maggie's breathing caught in a little hitch, then she put out her hand and sank it into the dog's fur. They both sighed in their sleep and went motionless again. I stood there for a moment just looking down at them. Thomas usually busied himself with coffee in the kitchen at moments like this, but today he stepped up beside me and stood there, looking at the girl and the dog. "Damn," he said. I nodded. "Big responsibility."
"Yeah,
you can do it." I turned to look at him. There was some expression I couldn't define on his face, some mix of longing and gentle, exquisite pain.
"I don't think so, Harry," he said.
"Don't be a dope," I said. "You love her. You'll love the kid. Of course you can." A faint, sad smile mixed in with the other expressions on his face. We both turned back to the sleeping child. There was a quality to the stillness that I had never experienced before I'd started taking care of Maggie. A sense of intense satisfaction, like nothing I'd ever known. There she was, sleeping, happy, healthy, safe. I took a deep, stabilizing breath. Weariness fled, not from my body, but from somewhere deeper and infinitely more important. My brother exhaled at the same time and thumped his fist on my shoulder. Then he turned for the kitchen and I headed for the shower. I broiled myself for as long as seemed appropriate, and as I was getting dressed, I heard voices from the kitchen.
"Milk doesn't have feelings," Maggie was saying.
"Why not?"
piped a voice even younger.
"Because milk is inanimate,"
Maggie said cheerfully.
"Oh."
There was a pause.
"But it is moving."
"I moved it," Maggie said, "and then it sloshes around for a while."
"Why?"
"Because of gravity, I think," Maggie said, "or maybe momentum."
"Do you mean momentum?"
the littler voice asked.
"I might,"
Maggie said seriously.
"How do you know then?"
"When you're 10, you'll know things too," Maggie said.
"Why?"
I walked into the apartment's little kitchen to find Maggie in her pajamas making a mess with the attentive help of Mouse and a skull carved from wood. Little green dots of light glowed in the skull's eye sockets like the embers of some bizarre fire. Half the contents of the apartment's little pantry were crowded onto the kitchen counter. I eyed Thomas, who was sitting at the kitchen table with a mug of coffee. He'd already poured mine. I walked over to him and took my cup, murmuring, "You didn't think to step in here?"
"You got in the shower so long ago, I forget exactly what I was thinking back in those days," he shot back.
I lowered my voice a little.
"How did she do?" I asked him.
He spoke in kind.
"Pretty good. We exchanged good mornings, made eye contact, and she seemed happy to do it," he said. "She asked me if I wanted pancakes."
"And you said yes?"
"Harry," Thomas said, "be real. Everyone wants someone to make us pancakes. We're all just too grown up to say it."
I sipped coffee, because it was impossible to argue with logic like that. He sipped too.
"Are you going to stop her?"
I savored the perfection that is coffee and enjoyed that first swallow before responding.
"Think I'd better scout it out."
I took my cup into the kitchen and heard Thomas get up to tag along. When I came into its line of sight, the little wooden skull's eyes swiveled to me, and her voice proclaimed proudly,
Pancakes are inanimate.
Correct, I said, speaking to the spirit inside the skull. Better inside that wooden one than mine, let me tell you. Ever since the new formed spirit of intellect had coalesced inside my mind, it had grown until it was too big for the space, which admittedly had not taken her very long. We'd managed to successfully get her out of my head, and she'd taken up residence in the carved wooden skull prepared for her. Ever since, we'd been teaching her and answering a river of endless questions. Good morning, Bunea.
Morning is when the sun comes up, the little skull said. It ends at noon.
Bunea was full of points of information that didn't connect to anything else. She could tell you the particulars of all sorts of secrets of the universe, but she'd have no idea what kind of an effect those secrets could have on the actual world, which made her someone to be carefully managed. Correct again, I said. Good morning, Maggie.
Hi, Dad, Maggie said. I'm making us all pancakes for breakfast.
Which is awesome, Thomas said, nudging me in the small of the back. Maggie threw him a swift glance and a shy smile. I didn't have to look to know he winked back at her. I lifted my eyebrows. Yeah, pancakes. That's new.
Molly says you have to be brave and to try new things to grow, my daughter said seriously. And Thomas says everyone likes pancakes.
Everyone likes pancakes, Thomas said. I gave him a narrow-eyed look over my shoulder to tell him to stop helping me. He returned it with a guileless smile.
Well, they're not wrong, I said seriously. Do you want any help?
I can do it by myself, she said. I know how to work the stove, and Bonnie knows the recipe. I know 227 individual pancake recipes, Bonnie said. 16 can be made with the current inventory of the kitchen. We're using number 7, Maggie said seriously. From scratch is best.
That sounded like the makings of a huge mess to me. Mouse gave me what I swear was a smug look and licked his chops. It would be extra work to clean up afterward, but it would probably be good for Maggie to try it. So I leaned down and kissed her on the head and said, Be careful of the stove, and let me know if you need help with anything, Pumpkin.
See there, Miss Maggie, Thomas said. I told you so.
I stopped and eyed him.
Did you set all this up so you could get pancakes?
Thomas put on a serious expression and widened his eyes a little at Maggie.
I'm not saying that I didn't.
I rolled my eyes at him. My daughter giggled.
Mr. Thomas is okay, Dad.
You are very young. Tell you what, you let me deal with him, I said. You keep your mind on what you're doing, okay? Be safe.
Okay, she said.
She turned back to the task, and though her eyes were still puffy with sleep, she focused on the work with the instant morning energy that can be possessed only by someone who has not yet discovered the immutable necessity of coffee. I settled down on the couch nearby. The apartment was basically a single large room, sharing the kitchen, the dining room, and a living room with no walls between. There were two doors to the two bedrooms, Molly's and mine. Well, technically the room was Molly's. As far as I knew, she hadn't actually been in it since I'd moved in, except for a couple of times she'd breezed through, petted Mouse, tickled Maggie, shared some sunny chat with me, and departed again. It had been a while since we'd really talked. The apartment reminded me of my old place in the basement of Mrs. Spunklecreef's boarding house. Only there was no musty, moldy smell of old basement, and it was bigger, and it was more brightly lit, and newer, and quite a bit cleaner, and it just didn't feel right. As dumpy as it had been, that grotty little apartment had been my home. Damn the vampires for burning it down. Damn Marcone for buying the property and putting up his new headquarters on the ground where home used to be. I missed it. Ah, well, there was no sense in brooding over it. Life never stays the same. There's always some kind of curveball coming at you. Nothing to do but swing away. Thomas picked a spot of wall to lean against where he could see the kitchen and sipped his coffee. His eyes were focused on Maggie with thoughtful intensity.
Living dangerously, eh?
Mouse will let me know if there's a problem, I said.
Good dog there, Thomas said.
You want, I said, I could write to Brother Wang, tell him you want a puppy.
You already stole that one from him, Thomas snorted.
Accidentally, I said. Plus, I think the furball stowed away on purpose. Even if Brother Wang doesn't like it, I figure he won't gainsay the dog.
Well, Thomas mused, he is a pretty good dog.
Damn right he is, I said.
Let me think about it, Thomas said. There's a lot going on.
He still hadn't taken his eyes off Maggie.
Hey, man, I said. You okay?
He glanced aside at me and offered me a faint smile.
Just thinking real hard about the future.
Well, I said, that's understandable. I closed my eyes and felt my limbs aching in dull, steady throbs that kept time with my heartbeat. Suddenly, I sneezed hard.
God bless you,
Maggie said promptly from the kitchen.
Oh, I said. Thank you.
The sneeze had sent a surge of aching sensation through my limbs that took several seconds to fade. I opened one eye.
That wasn't right.
The mantle of power from the winter night was what let me keep pace with my brother the vampire while running in sand and wearing 200 pounds of extra weight. One of the things the mantle did was to dull pain, to the point where I experienced it only as a kind of tense, silvery sensation. Broken bones were sort of annoying. A bleeding wound was something of a distraction. But I didn't ever, ever just ache. Except now, I was. Stupid winter mantle. It kept up a constant assault of primal, feral emotions and desires that were like supercharged versions of my own instincts. I didn't go out for intense exercise every morning because I enjoyed it. I did it because discipline and routine helped me keep the more primal instincts in check. Daily intense exercise forced the mantle to expend energy in keeping my body going, on my schedule, at my will, and as a result, reduced the amount of pressure it could apply to my conscious thoughts. And while it did make me able to ignore pain and to push my body well beyond the normal limits of human endurance, the mantle's influence was a steady nuisance that required constant effort to keep buttoned up.
Whoa, Thomas said. You okay there, nerd?
That was weird, I said. Mister prowled up onto the couch and settled on my lap, thrusting his head beneath my hand. I petted him automatically, and his body rumbled with a purr that sounded like a pot of boiling water. A second or two after that thought, I sneezed again, harder, and this time the aching surge sent a wave of exhaustion flooding through me, so hard that I nearly fell onto my side. Also, there was a clang and a splashing sound. Mister leapt out of my lap and bolted. It took me a couple of tries to get my eyes to focus, but when I did, I saw that a metal pot with a black plastic handle was lying on its side on the carpet in front of me. Little wisps of steam rose from the soaking carpet next to the pot. I blinked up at Thomas and traded a look with him. His face told me that he had no idea what had just happened. We both looked back at the pot. I frowned and leaned down to touch it. It wasn't quite hot enough to burn me, but it was close. I blinked at it and reached for the handle. I picked up the pot. The handle felt oddly squishy for a couple of seconds. And then suddenly, plastic and metal and water alike shuddered and melted into a clear, gelatinous fluid that fell out of my fingers to splat on the carpet. Ectoplasm. The raw matter of the spirit world.
What the hell?
Ectoplasm was a strange substance. It could be shaped by magic and fed energy, and as long as the energy kept pouring in, it would hold its form. Spirits from the Never-Never could forge bodies to be used in the material world and run around in them, like their own version of going on a spacewalk. But once the energy stopped pouring in, the construct body would revert to its original form, mucus-like ectoplasm, which would itself sublimate from the material world and back to the never-never within moments.
So where the hell did the pot come from?
The guard? The little fairies who loitered about my home certainly had a mischievous streak a mile wide. Could one of them have played a prank on me? Maybe. But if so, how had the prankster known what I was thinking about? It was damn peculiar.
Harry? Thomas asked.
Damn peculiar, I said, and swiped at my nose, which was suddenly all but overflowing, even for me.
Dad? Maggie called.
Hmm?
I'm not supposed to flip the pancake until it's golden brown, Bonnie says, but I can't see the cooked part. How do I know?
I pushed myself up off the couch, grabbed a handful of tissues, and headed for the kitchen.
It's a little tricky, I said. You can tell from what the batter on the uncooked side looks like. I'll show you. Okay.
I started instructing my daughter in the fine art of pancake flipping. We had just gotten the second one started when a tiny bell began to ring very rapidly from somewhere in one of the walls. The apartment's security alarm. Mouse whipped his head around to the source of the sound and let out a low growl. Maggie blinked and then looked at me uncertainly. Thomas came off the wall in a tense little bound of tightly leashed energy. He glanced at me and then went to the kitchen and took one of the big chef's knives from the block.
Someone's coming, I said. Let's see what's happening first. Now, just like we practiced, take Bonnie, go to my room, and put her in her box. Stay in there with her, stay low to the ground, and keep quiet, okay?
Maggie looked uncertain, but she nodded.
Okay.
Go on. I shut the bedroom door behind her and picked up my wizard staff from its spot near the fireplace. I suddenly wished that I'd found a way to spend more hours on my personal magical arsenal. I hadn't because I'd been busy being a father, which took up way more time than I'd believed possible. There'd been very little time to actively work on my gear, a very wizard hours intensive endeavor. All I had was the staff I'd carved out on the lost island of Demon Reach in the middle of Lake Michigan, my blasting rod, and a slapdash version of my old shield bracelet, but they would have to do. Whatever had set off the alarm, it seemed unlikely that it could march all the way through the Svartalv's security, but if it hadn't done so, then why was my security alarm ringing?
What do you think? Thomas asked.
I think anything that goes through Svartalv security to get here has me a little edgy, I said.
Oh, so it's not just me. That's nice.
A few seconds later, a heavy hand rapped hard on the door to the apartment. I checked to make absolutely sure that the door to the room with my daughter inside was firmly shut. And then, gripping my staff much like a rifle, I paced silently forward to answer the door, my brother falling into step beside me.
Chapter 3. I summoned my will and channeled power into my staff. The runes spiraling along its length smoldered with emerald fire, and tiny wisps of smoke rose from it. The clean, smoky scent of fresh scorched wood laced the air. Runes and sigils of green light spangled the walls. A wizard's staff is a versatile tool. I could use one to project any number of forces or effects as the need arose, and I made sure mine was ready to wreak havoc or reflect energy as needed. Thomas moved in utter silence to the wall beside the door, where he would be within arm's reach of anyone who came through it. He gripped the knife low along his leg and nodded to me when he was ready. I calmly opened the apartment's front door. An old man stood there. He was a couple of inches shorter than average and stout. Like me, he carried a staff, though his was a good deal shorter and, like him, stouter than my own. Some wisps of white and silver hair drifted around his otherwise shining head, though there seemed to be more liver spots on the skin than I remembered from the last time I'd seen him. His dark eyes were bright, though, behind his spectacles, and he wore a plain white cotton t-shirt with his blue overalls and steel-toed work boots. He was my mentor, Ebenezer McCoy, senior member of the White Council of Wizardry. He was also my grandfather. The old man eyed me, his brow furrowing in thought, studying me as I stood there, and then my green, glowing staff.
"New work," he noted. "Dense, though. Maybe a little rough."
"All I had was a pocket knife," I said. "No sandpaper. Had to use rocks."
"Ah," he said. "May I come in?"
I looked past Ebenezer to where Ostry stood in the hall, one hand inside his suit, a couple of fingers pressed to one ear. His lips were moving, though I couldn't hear what he was saying. "Ostry, what's with the alarm?"
Ostry apparently listened to something coming into his ear that only he could hear and nodded. He didn't take his hand out of his coat when he answered me.
"This person is known to the Svartalfs," he said. "He is an enforcer for the White Council of Wizardry and is known to be extremely dangerous. He did not follow security protocols."
"I don't have 48 hours to wait for DNA tests to come back, even if I'd give you any," Ebenezer growled. "I told you, Etri knows me. He'll vouch for me."
There was an odd, almost rippling sound, and suddenly a dozen more Svartalfs, like Ostry, just slid up out of the floor as if it had been made of water. They were grasping a number of weapons, both modern and ancient, but they didn't move to attack. Impulsive responses were not a part of their nature. Their expressions were unreadable, but definitely not friendly. Ostry eyed Ebenezer and then looked to me. "Wizard Dresden, is this person to be considered a guest of Miss Carpenter?"
"That would be simplest for all involved, I think," I said.
"Simple?" Ostry asked. "It is irrelevant how simple or how complicated it may be. Is he Miss Carpenter's guest or not?"
"He is," I said. "Let him come in. I'll take responsibility for his conduct while he's here."
Ostry frowned for a long moment, his expression taking on several nuanced shades of doubt. But he only lowered his hand from his jacket and nodded to me. At a gesture, he and the rest of the Svartalf security team filed down the hallway and out of sight.
"Sticklers, aren't they?" I said.
"Goes a great deal deeper than that," Ebenezer said.
"You push their buttons on purpose," I said.
"Not at first, but one of them got snotty with me."
"So you just started walking over them?"
Something mischievous sparkled in the back of his eyes.
"It's good for them, from time to time, for someone to remind them that they can't exercise control over everything, and that a member of the senior council can walk where he chooses to walk."
His eyes crinkled at the corners.
"That last guy really got to me."
"Gedwig," I said. "The grouchy. He's always extra paranoid." I let the power ease out of my staff, and the runes stopped glowing, the light dying away. I made a gesture toward Thomas with one hand, and my brother eased away from the door. Then I stood aside and opened the door wider for my grandfather.
"Come in."
The old man didn't miss much. He came in with the calm, wary look of a man who isn't focused on one thing because he's taking in everything, and immediately spun his staff to point squarely at Thomas.
"What is that thing doing here?" Ebenezer demanded.
Thomas lifted his eyebrows.
"Thing? Pretty bold assertion of righteousness from a White Council's hatchet man."
As far as I knew, my grandfather didn't know that Thomas and I shared a mother, his daughter. He didn't know he had another grandson. Ebenezer had kind of a thing about White Court vampires. The Paranet called them vampires, but I refused to cave in to such silliness unless it became entirely convenient.
"Vampire," my grandfather growled. "You've been a useful ally to young Dresden up until now. Don't go ruining things by getting my attention."
Thomas's eyes glittered a shade brighter, and he put on a smile he wore when he was exceptionally furious.
"I'm hearing a lot of loud talk from a guy who let himself get this close to someone like me without having a shield already up."
"Why, you slick little punk," my grandfather began. The stench of burning batter filled the air, and I stalked over to the stove where I flipped the pancake, which had burned during the altercation. Then I slapped the spatula back down onto the counter with unnecessary force and said, words sizzling with vitriol, "Gentlemen, I should not need to remind either of you that you are guests in my home." And that hit them both like a bucket of cold water. In our world, maybe the closest thing to inviolable laws are the ancient traditions of guest right and host right. In them, guests are to be honored and treated as members of the host's own family. And they, in turn, are expected to behave as respectful members of the host's own family. And in this case, we all were actual family, only my grandfather didn't know it. But Thomas backed off a bit more, his tense frame easing out of its predatory stance, and my grandfather lowered his staff and turned until he was partially facing away from Thomas.
"Sorry, Harry," Thomas said. "Won't happen again."
I nodded at him and glanced at the old man.
"I owe you an apology," my grandfather said to me, with heavy emphasis on the pronouns. "Shouldn't have behaved like that in your home. I'm sorry."
Well, clearly this morning wasn't going in anyone's photo album, but it wasn't going to result in a funeral either. Take your wins where you can get them, I guess. "Thank you," I said to them both. I held out my hand and Thomas passed me the chef knife's handle. I put the knife away and cleared my throat at my grandfather. He eyed Thomas, the look a threat. Then he abruptly eased his stance and spoke in conversational tones. "Those pancakes I smell?" he asked, setting his staff in the corner by the door. I put mine with his.
"Yeah, just making us some breakfast." "Harry," Thomas said, "I'm going to go."
"You don't have to," I said. He eyed Ebenezer, his lips compressed.
"Yeah, I do."
"Thomas," I began. My brother held up his hand to forestall me, his face a thundercloud, and stalked out. My grandfather watched him go until the door closed behind him. Then he glanced up at me from behind the ridge of his shaggy eyebrows. "Thanks for that," I said.
"You should thank me," he said without heat. "Telling you, you don't know them like you think you do."
"The white court might be bad on average," I said, "but that one's okay."
"Which is exactly what everyone they've ever seduced will tell you about them," my grandfather said, scowling.
But he held up a hand and his tone turned apologetic.
"Look, Hoss, your business is your own. I don't come riding in here all the time trying to run your life. And I shouldn't have thrown a wrench in whatever you had going with the vampire. But you're young, and I got experiences with them and perspective on them that you don't. I don't want you to figure it out the hard way, that's all."
I frowned at the old man. If he was explaining his reasoning instead of leaving me to do it myself, he was worried.
"There he is," Ebenezer said, smiling as Mouse came shambling over to greet him.
He ruffled the dog's ears with brisk fondness.
"I don't have much time, so I'll come right to it. You're in trouble."
"Uh-huh," I said. I went back into the kitchen and poured batter onto the griddle. "First time we've spoken face to face since Chechen Itza. All business, huh, sir?" He took that in for a moment, his eyes narrowing slightly.
"We've all had our hands full since that night," he said. "People have been dying. You don't know what it's been like out there."
"I missed you too," I said. "I'm likewise glad to see you alive and in one piece."
"There isn't time for this," he said.
"Pancakes?" I asked. "I'm always pretty hungry after my morning constitutional." The old man's voice hardened.
"I'm not kidding, grandson," he said. "There has been a motion raised before the General Council to strip you of your status as a member of the White Council entirely."
I arched an eyebrow sharply.
"Huh.
First the Council forces me to wear one of those damn gray cloaks, whether I want one or not. Now they're talking about kicking me out. I'm going to get whiplash."
"You're going to get more than that if the motion passes," he said, heat in his tone.
Then he visibly took a moment to forcibly calm himself.
"Harry, I want to get caught up too. I want to talk, clear the air.
And we will, but right now is no moment to let your emotions run your life." I scowled down at the pancake. I'd had all kinds of practice in keeping my emotions in check lately. All right, I said. Truce, for now. What pretext is the council basing this upon?
An aggregate of various factors, he replied. Your non-standard elevation to full wizard, for example. The number of times you've involved yourself in high-profile cases. Your insistence on operating openly as a wizard for over a decade. Not least of which, the conflict of interest a claim now lies upon you due to your service to Queen Mab. A service that has apparently also brought a proven warlock into Mab's influence beside you.
It's all true, I said. I haven't lied to anyone about any of it. It's all on the record, so what's the problem?
The problem is that trust is getting harder and harder to come by in the White Council, Ebenezer said. Your choices have made you an outlier. Suspicion naturally falls upon someone in your position in times of strain. I flipped the pancake. I timed it right. It was golden brown.
If they boot me, I said, thinking through it aloud, it means I will no longer have the protection of the council. I won't be an official wizard.
You made a great many enemies over the years, Ebenezer said. So have I. If you were outcast from the council, your enemies and mine would see you occupying a weakened position. They'll do something about it. How much protection can Mab provide you?
Mab, I said, is not all that into safety. She mostly provides the opposite of that, actually.
The way she figures it, the only way she could make me perfectly safe would be to cut my throat and entomb me in amber. The quip did not draw a smile from the old man. He stared at me with craggy non-amusement. I sighed. It isn't Mab's job to protect her knight. It's supposed to be the other way around. If something comes along and kills me, I clearly wasn't strong enough to be your knight in the first place.
You aren't taking this seriously, he said. I flipped the pancake onto the pile and poured out batter for the next. If it gets bad, I can always fall back to Demon Reach.
God, if they knew the whole truth about that place, Ebenezer muttered. And then what?
Stay trapped on your island for the rest of your life, afraid to step off it?
So don't let the motion go to a general vote, I said. You're on the senior council. Pull rank. Assume control of it.
I can't, Ebenezer said. Without a quorum, it's got to be a general vote. And four of the senior council are going to be at the peace talks when the vote takes place.
My stomach twisted a little.
Which four?
Me, Christos, Listens to Wind, and Martha Liberty.
Oh, I said quietly.
My grandfather was a cagey old fox, with a thick network of alliances throughout the White Council, and almost as many enemies. The Merlin himself couldn't stand Ebenezer, and of the three senior council members who would preside over the next council meeting, only the gatekeeper had ever shown me any kind of fondness. Even if the vote could go to the senior council, I'd lose 2-1. Of course, I wasn't sure about how I would fare among the general population of the White Council either. Wizards live a long time, and they don't do it by taking unnecessary risks. If you look up unnecessary risk in the White Council's dictionary, my picture is there. And my address, and all my personal contact information, and my permanent record from middle school.
You need to talk to some of them face to face, Ebenezer said. Shake some hands. Make sure they know who you are. Reassure them. You only have a few days, but if you move fast, I think you can gather enough support to defeat the motion.
No, I said, I can't. Not without neglecting my duties as a warden and the Winter Knight both.
What? He asked.
I told him about my meeting with Ramirez that morning. I've been assigned to look out for you at the summit and to liaise with Winter.
The old man spat a curse.
Yeah, I said. Most of my support in the senior council was getting sent away at exactly the same time I was given a high-profile assignment providing security for the peace summit.
Meanwhile, of the wizards who actually did know me, Ramirez and his bunch were the ones who would probably speak on my behalf, and they'd been sent to the summit too. I'm being set up.
Huh,
Ebenezer agreed. Was it the Merlin? I asked. Kind of feels like his style.
Maybe, my grandfather said. On the other hand, Christos is throwing around a lot of orders these days, too. Hard to say where it comes from. I flipped the pancake. If I hadn't spent years with the old man, I wouldn't have noticed anything in his tone. But there was a peculiar shade of emphasis to his phrasing that made me glance up at him. He'd said Christos, but what he meant was... The Black Council, I said. He grimaced at me, and then at the walls. The Black Council was secret stuff. Some unknown folks in the wizarding community had been causing a great deal of mischief in my life over the past decade and more. Their goals were no clearer than their identities, but it was obvious that they were damn dangerous. Wizard Christos had ascended to the senior council under odd circumstances. Circumstances that seemed to indicate that the Black Council was exercising power within the council itself. A white council that was bumbling and fussy and not interested in anything but its own politics was a fairly terrible but normal thing. But a white council that was being directed by the kind of people I'd run into over the years was a nightmare that barely bore thinking upon. A few of us had gotten together to see if we could stop it from happening, because secret societies within the White Council were seen as evidence of plotting to overthrow it, we had to be really, really careful about our little cabal. Especially since we were kind of plotting against the White Council, even if we were doing it for its own good. I sweep it 3 times a day, and I have the little folk on the lookout for any possible eavesdropping, I said. No one is listening in on us.
Good, Ebenezer said. Yes. Whether Christos is an open servant of the Black Council or just their puppet, I think it's safe to say they want you gone.
So what else is new? I asked.
Don't be cute, Ebenezer said. They've been running operations, and sometimes you've interfered, but they've never come at you directly.
Guess I was a headache one time too many.
My point is, he said, whatever's happening here, your removal has become a priority to them.
I flipped another pancake and bobbled it. Some of the batter splattered and smeared. I wasn't scared, exactly, but the Black Council had done some scary stuff.
What do you think? I asked him.
I think that these people aren't going to announce themselves, he said. They aren't going to come at you directly. They aren't going to be obvious, and they aren't going to give up. He squinted at me and said, this vote that's going... That's just the storm they're brewing up to distract you.
So we ignore it?
Storm can still kill you, whether you pay attention to it or not, he said. We still have to deal with it. That's what makes it an excellent distraction.
Then what do we do?
Don't get too focused on the situation that's being set up. They want you locked in on that, so you never see the real problem coming.
I finished another pancake and brought the plate of them over to the table. I divided them out, and my grandfather and I ate in quiet.
Good, he said. Thanks.
We wrapped up breakfast, and my mentor shook his head.
I'll see what I can do about this vote. Meanwhile, you do whatever you need to.
To do what? I asked.
To survive, he said.
He squinted at nothing in particular and said,
You've had it easy so far. In some ways.
Easy? I asked.
You've had troubles, he said, but you've gotten to play Lancelot at all of them. You've ridden forth to do open battle, and you've won the day.
Not all of them.
More than most would have, he said. I was like that once. Like you, now.
Silence stretched, and I didn't try to fill it.
You're getting into deeper weeds now, boy. The stakes are getting higher.
Meaning what?
The past few years have shown them that you aren't someone who is easily removed the direct way. They're going to start trying alternate methods.
Like what? I asked.
The old way, he said, his voice weary.
the way it always happens. I think someone you don't expect is gonna stab you in the back, Hoss.
Chapter 4. There was a very soft sound from the back of the apartment, and the old man came to his feet with the speed of an alley cat. Before he'd even got there, he'd hissed a word, and his staff flew across the room and into his hand.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," I said, rising, my hands spread. "Would you relax, please?"
"Who is that?" he demanded. He shot me a hard look.
"Who?"
"I just fed you pancakes," I muttered. How tense were things in the old man's world that he would react like that?
Stars and stones.
"Don't say that," he said, his tone slipping into a more familiar, grouchier cadence. "You don't even know what it means." "The guy I learned it from wouldn't teach me," I said back. "Would you relax for 5 seconds, please? Please?"
He glowered at me. He lowered the staff only slightly.
"Why should I?"
"Because I'd rather my daughter didn't have her great-granddad scare her to death on their first meeting," I said. At that, the old man blinked. Twice. He lowered his staff abruptly.
"What? She's here? She was here? This whole time?"
"She has trouble with new people," I said quietly. "It's hard on her." I looked down at Mouse and jerked my chin at the door to the bedroom. The big dog got up obediently and padded over to the door to be a reassuring presence for the girl.
"You let the vampire around her," my grandfather whispered, his expression shocked.
"Maggie," I called quietly, "please come out. There's someone I guess you should meet." The door opened only a little. I could see a sliver of her face and one brown eye peering out warily. "I want you to come meet your great-grandfather," I said quietly. "I hadn't actually pictured it quite like this," I said, with a glance at the old man. "But I guess we've got what we've got. Come on, Pumpkin." The door opened a little more. She reached out and felt around with one hand until her fingers found Mouse's fur. She curled them into his mane and then, very slowly, opened the door. She faced Ebenezer without moving or speaking.
"Maggie," he said quietly. His voice sounded rough.
"Hello, young lady."
She nodded at him a little. Ebenezer nodded back. Then he turned to me, and an anger I'd never seen before smoldered in his eyes. He opened his mouth to speak. Before he could, I gave him a warning glance and said, "How about we go up to the garden, and Mouse can stretch his legs?"
"Okay,"
Maggie said. The old man glared daggers at me, then schooled his expression and turned back to my daughter with a gentle smile.
"That sounds nice," he said.
I stood with Ebenezer and watched Maggie and Mouse play with Svartalf's children. The garden was gorgeous, centered on a couple of trees that grew in the courtyard in the middle of the Svartalf embassy. Grass and flowers had been planted in tasteful balance, leaving enough room for the children to run about and play hide-and-seek. Svartalf children are odd-looking little creatures, with their parents' gray skin and absolutely enormous eyes. Adorable, really. There were half a dozen kids in residence at the embassy of an age to play with Maggie, and all of them loved Mouse, who was engaging them all in a game of tag, lightly springing away from them and twisting and dodging despite all his massive muscle. Several Svartals were in the garden. They kept a polite physical and psychological distance from us, clearly savvy to the tension that currently existed between me and the old man.
"Are you insane?" Ebenezer asked me.
"I'm making a choice," I said.
"You might as well give her a shirt with a series of bullseyes on it," he said. He kept his voice pitched too low for the children to hear him. "You raise that child near you, and you're making her a target. My God, the vampires already know about her."
"She was in a safe house far away from me for a long time," I said. "It didn't work out so well."
"What was wrong with the carpenter's house?" he said. "Short of headquarters in Edinburgh, you couldn't find a better protected place. Why not leave her there?"
"Because her father doesn't live there," I said.
The old man looked up at the sky as though imploring the Almighty to give him patience.
You're a damn fool.
I ground my teeth. You have a better idea? She needs to be somewhere safe, somewhere away from you, at least until such time as she shows potential talent of her own so that she can learn to protect herself. Assuming she ever does. If she doesn't, our world will get her killed. At that, I felt my own temper rising.